reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. I believe we have some Moraine Park Technical College students with us. Is that right? Would you stand, please? And you are taking courses for legal secretary? Good. Well, welcome to the court. You may be seated. If you do not have a summary of the case we are about to hear, summaries are available outside on the desk. And I would strongly urge you to get one that's available for all of you and read it, because I think you will have a better understanding of the proceedings in this matter. We've met you. Let me introduce the court to you. And I'll start with Justice Lewis Butler on my far left. And he has a guest today, if you'd stand, Aaron Wells. Aaron is Justice Butler's nephew and is shadowing.
Maybe chaperoning.
He needs a chaperone.
We may think that, but we don't say that, Justice Wilcox. He is shadowing Justice Butler and is thinking he'd like to be a lawyer, will be in the legal profession in some manner, so we're not doing anything to discourage him, not the bench and not the bar, please. Thank you. Mr. Wells, you may be seated. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. With the introductions made, we will call our next case, 03-2827 Marine Bank versus Taz's Trucking, Inc. Representing Taz's Trucking, Inc. is Mark Schmidt. We then have divided the argument by Robert Stoyer and Barbara Janischek. Representing Marine Bank and the receiver. You may begin, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Good afternoon to the court. This case presents a very simple issue, and that is whether or not a carrier of freight which has delivered to a consignee and the consignee has accepted the delivery and accepted the benefits of the services provided by the carrier, in that situation, whether the carrier may collect from the consignee. Three prior cases from this court have so held. While not discussing the legal theories in particular depth, what I believe the cases all show is an adherence to the rule of quasi-contract. That is, that in the case like this, a benefit has been conferred upon the consignee. The consignee knows of and accepts the benefit, and it would be inequitable to the carrier if the consignee was not required to pay. I believe that is what underlies, what is the legal underpinning for the prior three decisions of this court. It is consistent with Wisconsin law overall. There is a recognized exception to that, at least reading between the lines of the Schneider case from the district court and the Wiley case from North Dakota. If there is an express agreement between the consignor and the consignee under which the consignor is solely liable for shipping, and the carrier knows about that agreement and acts in accordance, and if the consignee actually has paid for the shipping before demand by the carrier, then the consignee can assert that it's not liable. And this is under the well-established principles of equitable estoppel. We have an action by the carrier in collecting only from one party. We have reasonable reliance by the consignee upon a written contract the parties all know about, and it relies by paying for the shipping or including the cost of shipping in the underlying price of the goods. And it would be there would be a detriment to the consignee if it was forced to pay twice. That the elements of reasonable reliance on a written contract and detriment to the consignee are both absent in this case. They were, however, present in the Schneider case and in the Wiley case. In Schneider, the 1994 district court case, the consignees were essentially transshippers. They received the shipments, split them up, carried them to ultimate consignees, collected, and they then paid the consignor. They shared the revenues with the consignor. So if Schneider Trucking could have collected from them again, they would have been harmed because they'd already paid once. There also was an underlying agreement which the district court said the carrier was, quote, explained thoroughly to the carrier, and it acted in accordance with that written contract.
Counselor, let me interrupt you just a minute.
Sure.
Just so I'm sure I understand what the facts are of this case. In this particular instance, TAS delivered goods to consignees.
Yes.
And those folks did not pay the consignor or Marine Bank for the charges that you're now trying to collect. Is that correct?
Absolutely. These are only unpaid charges.
Okay. So you're not going after them for something and trying to make them pay twice?
Absolutely not.
Okay. All right. Thanks. I just wanted to be sure.
Thank you, Your Honor. So if there was an underlying agreement so that the consignee, by paying the consignor, reasonably relied, and in that case, it could defend by saying, I should not be forced to pay twice. A similar pattern of facts occurred in the E.W. Wiley case. Again, the consignee actually had paid. There was a contract between the consignor and the consignee, and there was also an unsigned contract between the carrier and the consignor, all of which provided that the consignor solely would be liable. And the parties acted according to this.
Well, here, isn't there a practice that the consignor is liable? In the first few months, didn't didn't they pay for the shipping expenses and then bill their clients?
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that that is irrelevant in this case.
Why?
For a number of reasons. One, there is no express agreement. Number two, the consignees have never paid, so that they're not being harmed by allowing TAS to collect from them. And third, that the period of time where we have this course of dealing, as it were, was only a number of months. And in fact, in November of 2002, the president of TAS went to NBM and said, if you don't pay us, we're going to start collecting from the consignees directly, and the receivership was not filed until 2 months after that. So that there was at least expressed by TAS was their intention to collect from the consignees. And there certainly was no written contract here.
Now, if we hold for you, in effect, your client gets a priority over other creditors.
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because our client was the one who provided services to the consignees.
But doesn't the bank have an interest in all receivables?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And one of the receivables, they might say, is from the consignees.
I would disagree with that.
I know you do, but that's what I'm assuming is going to be their position, in that they would have, then you have to fight with them about who gets the money, you or them.
Yes.
And that's what this case is about.
Yes. In fact, we believe that we wouldn't even get to the issue of whether those are receivables because MBM did nothing to earn the right to receive those monies. And TAS, in effect, always had the right to collect from the consignees. It is the one who performed the services.
You performed the services, but at least for a few months, the consignees were billed, not by you, but by the shipper.
Correct.
And shipper collected and paid you, right?
Correct.
And you just want a different kind of arrangement here.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that there's a different type of arrangement. I'm suggesting that the underlying law is that we, TAS, always had the right to collect from the consignees.
Now, does it matter that you're a common carrier or not a common carrier?
No, it does not, Your Honor. The differences between a common carrier and a contract carrier were essentially done away with the repeal of the ICC Act in 1995. And if you look at Wisconsin law, the definition of a common carrier and a contract carrier is almost indistinguishable.
Except the common carrier carries people and the contract carrier carries freight, right?
No, a common carrier can call people on freight.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Does it matter that you have a uniform bill of lading or just a bill of lading?
There is no more uniform bill of lading. That, again, was one of the red herrings present here. In the district court case in Schneider, and prior to 1995, that was a 1994 case, we had the Interstate Commerce Act, and you had all the regulations which set forth in detail what was required in a bill of lading. When the act was repealed and the regulations were essentially done away with, the detailed requirements for a bill of lading were gone. They no longer are in the regulations.
What kind of rule of law do you want to come out of this case?
The rule of law I want to come out is the one which was consistent with this court for 80 years, which is that if a carrier delivers goods to a consignee, that consignee accepts those goods, accepts the benefit of the services provided by the carrier, that the carrier can collect from the consignee.
Exclusively.
Pardon?
The consignee should pay you, and if they pay the consignor, that's no good?
If they pay the consignor under the situations where they could reasonably assert equitable estoppel or a similar theory, then they could defend on that ground. Apart from that, they are liable.
So, to protect themselves, the consignee has to pay you. Assuming the carrier delivers the goods are accepted, then the consignee, to protect himself, itself, has to pay you.
Yes, Your Honor. Although, if the consignor has paid us, we obviously are not going to try to collect twice. And this can be subject...
Suppose the consignee pays the consignor.
Under a situation where the carrier has done nothing wrong,
right,
then the consignee would be liable to the carrier.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Have the consignees paid for the goods to MBM?
They had not. The goods, the payments for the goods and the carriage were both outstanding.
Okay. And would the consignees say that the charges they got for the goods included the costs of shipment?
I don't know if that's possible, but what happened here is, for the court's benefit, there was a stipulation in the trial court that the payments for the goods and carriage would be collected and placed in escrow pending the termination of this action So the parties were able to determine out how much was for the goods and how much was for carriage. That's not an issue which is present here.
And in prior dealings, the shipper did separate out the charges for the goods and the carriage, and the consignee paid the shipper, the consignor.
Yes.
At least for a few months.
At least for a few months, there was a billing which the parties, at least between the carrier and the consignor, could sort out and say, this is how much is for the carriage, this is how much is for the goods. They had a means of doing that, and that's in the record.
Counselor, didn't MBM also tell your client to go collect from the consignees?
No, our client went to them and said, if you're not paying us, we're going to go collect from the consignees.
So it wasn't their suggestion that you go do that?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thank you.
When your client went to MBM, did MBM say you can't do that?
What my understanding from the record is that MBM asked them not to and made some representations. There was a claim in the Court of Appeals of an estoppel against Marine Bank or the receiver based upon that, but that had not been briefed below, and so it was not an issue addressed by the Court of Appeals. But in the record, at least, it appeared that MBM had done something to convince Taz to hold off on the collection.
The receivership, it's Chapter 128, is it?
Yes, sir.
Who gets to file that?
Well, in this case, it was filed by Marine Bank against MBM, and Mr. Stoyer was their suggested receiver.
Does he work for Marine Bank, or is there any conflict of interest between Mr. Stoyer and Marine Bank, or what?
I am not asserting any conflict of interest, Your Honor. I believe he would be paid from the assets in the estate.
I mean, could Taz's have filed for a receivership?
If it had a judgment, yes. A pre-judgment receivership is, I know that there are a very limited number of ways to do it, but without a judgment or without being a secured creditor, no. What one thing that has escaped in some of the later briefing was the policy and the equitable implications of the rule which this court has adhered to in the past, and the rule accepted by the Court of Appeals. The current law is both fair and just. The consignee knows, which knowingly accepts the benefits of cartage, becomes liable, and the carrier which has provided the services gets paid. It's predictable. In a case such as this, where there's no written contract to the contrary, the carrier is assured of its rights. It knows it can collect from the consignee which has accepted the goods. It's expeditious. It allows the carrier to deliver promptly without exercising its lien rights over the goods. It can go in at a moment's notice, pick up, and deliver. It's a long-standing rule. This court can presume, and as it does in other cases, that the parties have tailored their actions according to this rule. It's been here for 80 years. It is something which parties in commercial transactions presumed to be aware of the law will have tailored their actions to comply with. And also, it's consistent with the theory of stare decisis. intertemporal consistency buttresses the authority of the court. It, by applying the law consistently and only deviating when there are new needs, where the old law is no longer workable, where the world changes, the law changes to keep up. But willy-nilly, changing the law undermines the authority of the court.
Counselor, is there anything about the receivership that would have prevented Taz from exerting lien rights over the property that it delivered to the consignees at the time of delivery?
No, Your Honor. The lien rights expire at the moment the carrier delivers the goods to the consignee. So whatever lien rights it had were gone upon the moment of shipment or delivery.
Okay, so once they give them, they give the goods, the lien rights are gone, and they have no further right to put a lien on those goods for payment.
Right.
Okay.
And that is one of the points which I wanted to make about the Court of Appeals decision being completely commercially inefficient. If a carrier has to assert its lien rights against the consignee in order to assure payment, it will slow commerce considerably. If the only way that a carrier, which has received payments from a consignor in the past, the only way it can be assured that it will be able to be paid is to assert those lien rights and not deliver the goods until it is paid. I have cited one case from the federal courts.
Mr. Schmidt, before
yes.
you go further, let me just ask you, the Court of Appeals decision, as I read it, seems to rely rather heavily on the Schneider National case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And seems to indicate that the bill of lading in the Schneider National matter is very similar in wording to the bill of lading in these cases, in these
yes.
matters.
Yes, Your Honor.
And seems to put some real significance on the fact that because they're so similar, that the same rule, the Schneider National rule, should apply to this situation. What's your response to that?
My response to that is that the district court relied upon then-existing regulations for interstate commerce, which specified very detailed requirements for a bill of lading. And the bill of lading in Schneider did not comply with those standards. In 1995, however, those regulations were repealed. The bill of lading rules now are extraordinarily simple. And so the justification in Schneider for saying there's something wrong with this bill of lading because it doesn't comply with the regulations no longer exists because the regulations no longer exist.
Well, if the regulations no longer existed after 1995,
correct.
Why would your client continue to use a bill of lading that basically would have conformed, or I'm sorry, I'm saying that wrong, would have not conformed to the requirements? In other words, would have been basically similar to the Schneider bill of lading. Why wouldn't they say, hey, we can change this. We don't have to get into this kind of a situation.
Yeah, I believe if I understand the question correctly, currently, a bill of lading only has very minimal requirements, and the CASIS complies with those minimum requirements. Prior to 1995, there were much more detailed requirements. Since 1995, those have been stripped out as unnecessary. They no longer need those to
apply. So the criticism in Schneider National was that the bill of lading was too simple, if you will. It didn't meet all the requirements of the ICC Act.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so there would be no need for your clients. Your response would be there's no need for your clients to in any way alter the bill of lading because they didn't have to be concerned about meeting the ICC requirements.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So you find no significance in the fact that the bill of lading in Schneider and the bill of lading here would have been similar in nature.
No, Your Honor, because they arise under different law.
All right. Thank you.
Good
If two other...
Could I ask you, I'm not quite sure how to ask this, but are the principles involving receivership different from principles involving bankruptcy in terms of creditors?
There are significant differences between the Bankruptcy Code and Chapter 128. Chapter 128 is a very simple statute. It has very little case law developing it. The Bankruptcy Code, however, has very extensive rules on what is the property of the estate and what interests the trustee or the debtor in possession has in the property of the estate or property of the pre-existing debtor. And has extensive case law interpreting that, so that the underlying law is different and the case law developing it is substantially different.
So if, is it Mr. Stewart? If he were a trustee in bankruptcy, would you be arguing the same thing or not?
Yes, I would, because I don't believe that the amounts owed by the consignees ever would be considered receivables of the debtor or justly earned receivables of the debtor. And I do point out that the LTV or Shadow Gay case, the one bankruptcy case out of the Eastern District of New York, which did so hold, I have never seen another case in the 17 years since that decision, which has followed, in a bankruptcy situation. It's never arisen that I know of. The other pitfalls, as it were, of the Court of Appeals ruling is that it's unpredictable. A carrier which has collected some amount from a consignor never knows when it stepped over the line. It's lost its ability to collect from the consignee. Especially here where there is no written contract, we have a very short period of time where the parties dealt together. We don't know when that loss of rights springs into existence. It causes unpredictability among parties dealing in these commercial transactions. The last point I'd like to make is again the stare decisis issue, which has we addressed, I think, fairly comprehensively. The bank has presented nothing to suggest why the prior rule was wrong, why it's unworkable, why it needs to be changed. It's a law which has worked, it's a common law rule which has worked for almost a century. We see nothing in their policy statements or arguments to suggest why that rule just doesn't work anymore. I believe it does. I believe this Court should adhere to it. I notice I have my warning light on, so I believe I should be sitting down. Is that the time?
You still have till the red light goes on.
Oh, I do. Oh, excuse me.
Which it now is.
Now it's on.
I was questioned by about 3 seconds.
Thank you, counsel. Good time. 5 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Stoyer.
Yes, absolutely.
You represent the receiver, correct? You are and represent the receiver.
I am the receiver, Your Honor. My name is Robert Stoyer of Milwaukee. I am the receiver of MBM, Modern Building Materials, Inc., which we call MBM, by virtue of an appointment under Chapter 128 by the Circuit Court of Kenosha County. As the receiver under Chapter 128 of the statutes, I can be appointed at the petition, either the voluntary assignment by the debtor or the petition of any creditor showing that the debtor is insolvent. That is to say, that the assets of the debtor are insufficient to pay its obligations. Or to put it another way, people who have money coming equitably and legally will not pay it. And so it is my obligation as receiver to collect the assets of the debtor, to liquidate those assets the best way I can, and to distribute those assets or the proceeds of the liquidation to the creditors.
Mr. Steuer, given MBM's actions in this case that led to this conundrum, why should it be the creditors of MBM that prevail as opposed to the shipper in this instance?
Among the creditors,
it sounds like either way somebody's not going to get paid.
That's correct. Among the creditors of MBM, according to the investigation that I undertook, was a $108,000 obligation to Taz's Trucking. It was a creditor. The issue, as Justice Abrahamson pointed out, is are they entitled to a different status, a priority? I believe that answered your question. I'm not sure. I tried. But having said that, the priorities are established under the law. Typically, you start with the secured creditors, which in this case is Marine Bank. Once the secured obligations are paid, then we distribute among the various creditors, tax authorities, expenses of administration, that kind of thing, until you get down to the general creditors. In this case, I must advise you, the other general creditors of MBM will receive nothing. Hear that?
Marine Bank gets everything, essentially, correct?
No, well, Marine Bank will receive has received the proceeds of what is here by virtue of their secured status.
Sure, I understand that.
And the amount collected is insufficient to satisfy that obligation.
Okay, so really there's one creditor that will be paid, Marine Bank.
In this case, yes.
Yeah, and not paid in full either.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
But having said that,
what you're doing is you're marshaling all the assets so that they can.
Yes.
So that they do have a security interest in.
And what I'm concerned about is that in every case where you have a receivership or an insolvency in bankruptcy or any other kind, you need an orderly method of the liquidation. Now, as you look at the claims of the creditors, you know how much they have coming. As you look at the assets, you know what assets are there. In this case, the assets included the accounts receivable, and the accounts receivable of MBM were for goods which had been delivered to customers. These goods, by the way, are sewer piping and manhole preformed concrete, very sizable pieces of stone, pieces of concrete that are used in a lot of municipal and other jobs.
Sir, I assume that someone supplied to MBM metal for the sewer pipe.
It was concrete.
Oh, concrete.
Yes, you have vendors who supplied the raw materials which were used to make the concrete. You had people who were employed by MBM. You had people who hauled these things around within the plant on the forklifts and lift trucks that were there. You have all kinds of suppliers. Everyone who contributed to the finished goods which were delivered and which were included in the purchase price, which was paid by the customers. The terms of shipment or the terms of sale were this is the fixed price. And the problem that concerns and should concern this court, it concerns me, is if you can start deducting off that price to pay various suppliers, including carriers or anyone else, then those assets are not assets of the estate and the ability to collect those assets becomes hampered. And it's for that reason that we sought and obtained injunctive relief in the circuit court, was because the interference with the collection was creating a problem.
Well, if I had been one of those consignees and I got a bill from MBM. I bought some sewer pipe. Is it going to say $1,000 per unit for the sewer pipe plus so much for shipping? Or what is the bill going to say to me?
In the first place, there is never an itemization of the costs of carriage for any individual shipment anywhere in the records. The bills that were sent to the customers said, contract price, X number of dollars, please pay. It was not broken down with any kind of cost of carriage or anything like that.
But there was, on the basis of established relationships, there was an understood charge for shipping, wasn't there?
There was apparently an agreed method between MBM and TASMS as to how much would be billed by TAS to MBM. But the bills do not break that down by carriage. The bills break it down by weekly charges. So whatever was in that week was billed. So if the I don't even want to use the word consignee, it's a customer, because there's no document anywhere referring to these people as consignees. If they asked how much were the charges, that cannot be determined. And when you go back and ask them for payment for those charges 4 months in the past and say, we want you to pay that, they're either paying things they've already paid in the ensuing 4 months to MBM, or they're going to be offsetting against the account receivable, which is the asset of the estate.
Now, let us just suppose that the deal between MBA and MBM and TAS was TAS would itemize, so if you sent to A, it would be, TAS would tell us how much. And then let us say that MBM would then bill each of the people to whom shipment was made, and there was payment made to MBM. You would view that payment to MBM as an asset of the receivership, or at least an asset upon which the bank had a security interest. Is that right?
I would.
Okay.
In the absence of something else.
Yes. Now, let us suppose that MBM and TAS had a contract that said, TAS, you ship, and you bill the customer. So it never comes to MBM. MBM separately bills for the goods, TAS bills for the shipment. Would you view that as contrary to the agreement between MBM and Marine Bank?
No.
So that assets were not coming into MBM?
Not at all.
So why are you going out after the money? What difference does it make to you whether there's a direct, we do it one way or another? I've given you two ways of doing it. Same way. With one, you want a security interest in it. The other way, you don't. You're letting money, a stream of potential income, away from you.
We can create an infinite variety of potential ways of structuring this transaction. The one that was always used historically in all of the cases cited to this court, except Spanier National and Wiley, was that upon acceptance of the goods, the carrier would issue a uniform bill of lading in a form which was prescribed. That bill of lading would then be delivered to MBM and sent separately from the goods to the consignee, who could read the bill of lading before anything else happened. The bill of lading expressed the terms of the contract of carriage. It expressed the amount that was due based upon the tariffs which were on file with the Interstate Commerce Commission or someone else. It was a fixed obligation. And the bill of lading expressed the obligation that the consignee named in the bill of lading would be liable for the cost of shipment, and the consignee would know how much. The consignee could protect himself or itself with that knowledge, and by signing the bill of lading, accepted the liability that was there. The consignee was an integral third party to that arrangement. And that was the distinguishing feature which gave common carriers special rights under the case law. When they structured the deal separately, when they didn't include the common carrier as, I'm sorry, when they did not include the consignee as part of the parties to the bill of lading and contract of carriage, and there was no assumption of liability to them, they were deprived of the ability to protect themselves. And they will pay twice. They are obligated on the contract, and if they pay the carrier, they're paying something for goods that they contracted to have someone else deliver to.
Mr. Steyer, is there any significance to the fact that the bill of lading that was utilized by the parties involved here was similar to the one that was used in Schneider National?
It's not that it was similar, but it was lacking the same information. That is to say, in this case and in Schneider National, and I think in Wiley, the documentation that was given, even though it was called a bill of lading, was not the contract of carriage. It had nothing to do. The Schneider decision says nothing about failing to comply with any requirements as being a basis for the decision.
And yet the Court of Appeals seems to, as I read their decision, put some significance on the fact that the bill of lading in Schneider and the bill of lading utilized here were very similar in terms of language.
Yes. Neither of them functioned as the contract of carriage. That's the key similarity. This is merely a delivery ticket. It is not a part, and if you read Schneider, it says the liability would exist, the consignee, if they were parties to the contract of carriage and if there was a document of title, the bill of lading. Lacking both of those things, even though they call it a bill of lading, it didn't fulfill the function under the law.
Mr. Steyer, if I can follow up on Justice Crook's question and refer directly to paragraph 22 of the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals, citing LTV Steel and Schneider National, says that under these cases, the evidence proves a course of conduct between MBM and TASS's establishing MBM's exclusive liability for freight charges, which overcomes the common law presumption of consignee liability. And I raise that question about their opinion because when I look at the facts of this case, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, TASS factored, that is, financed the MBM account in July of 2002. There had typically been a 30 to 60 day delay in payment, which would take us till September. Yet in November of 2002, before the receivership, TASS informs MBM that it would seek payment from the consignees if payment were not forthcoming. So I don't know that we have the record here to say that it was always done with the eye that we were going to pay from the consignors. You understand what I'm going?
Where I do. The other factor relied upon in all of these cases, whether it's Chateauguay, whether it's Wiley, whether it's Schneider, whether it's any of them, is that the ICC regulations have always required carriers to collect within 15 days. They could not extend credit because that's a form of discrimination which a common carrier could not engage in. Here, the fact that TASS has went out and arranged for some method of financing this past due account receivable instead of collecting immediately from MBM demonstrates that they were relying upon MBM's credit in doing what they were doing. And that continued until the day of the filing of the petition.
But what about the fact, and this is what I was getting at, the fact that they notified MBM in November, before the receivership, that if, hey, if we don't get paid, we're going to go after the consignees.
But they didn't. Unless something happens. Well, something happened, and 2 months later, they still hadn't done it.
But we're talking from September to November, as I understand the payment sequence. They wouldn't have known that they weren't being paid till September. Then you get to November, which when they send out the notice, and then January, that's when all the court action takes place, right?
There's no notice.
A very short period of time. We're not talking a long period of time.
There was no notice sent out. I don't know what...
I'm referring to page, and if it's wrong, please correct me. I'm referring to page 3 of the Mr. Schmidt's brief in the third paragraph where he says, and he cites a record at paragraph, maybe the Court of Appeals, at paragraph 13. No, record 18 at paragraph 13. TAS informed MBM in November 2002 that it would seek payment from consignees if payment from MBM was not forthcoming. It's right in the brief.
Right. They said they would do it if they didn't. Unless something was forthcoming, and something forthcame because 2 months later they still hadn't done it.
Right, but we're talking, what I'm getting at is that the assumption, at least from the Court of, from my reading of the Court of Appeals, is that we've got a long-standing practice here that had always been done in a particular way, when in fact we're talking about a very short time period.
Well, we're talking about, if you measure the time period by the 15 days, or, you know, payment in cash, we're talking about a very long payment time period. But the fact of the matter is that from March until November, those payments had always been very long. And in November, there's a discussion, and after that, there's a continuation of the business, and TAS continues to ship and continues to accept money from MBM during that period of time and does not go to anyone else. So we have no test as to whether they had a right to, and we certainly have no record as to what the consignees said or would have said had they done so.
Mr. Stoyer, what rule of law do you expect to come out of this case?
The rule of law, it should be the same as has been enunciated in the Schneider, Wiley, Chateauguay, other cases, and that is where the parties have acted under a three-party contract of carriage accepted by the consignee, in which the liability of the consignee is expressed, and which gives the carrier the opportunity to proceed against either party, then the consignee has the right to proceed according to the documentation of the parties. And the corollary to that, or the converse of that, the flip side, would be that a carrier, by virtue of being certainly a contract carrier, but a carrier, has no greater right to be paid what is owed to it by a debtor than any other creditor in an insolvency case.
Isn't that going to stop trucking companies from delivering goods or dealing at all with the consignor and requiring that the consignee pay them? Because if they are going to, they can at least have lien rights as long as they've got the goods in their possession. So isn't that going to interfere with the way business is really done?
The way business in general is run, including to my knowledge the transportation business, is that you rely upon the credit of your customer. And you make credit decisions. And the credit decision that was made by TAS in these circumstances, and was typical of the credit decision made by any other business, I'll rely upon the credit of my customer and expect to be paid by my customer.
But why?
And that works.
Why would you want to rely on one person when you had the right to rely on two people? What did you get for giving up that part of that ability to collect from somebody else?
The way they collect from somebody else is you use a uniform bill of lading and you have the consignee sign it. And the consignee tells them how much their potential liability is, and then they're...
That's under the old ICC Act, isn't it? No?
Well, that's what was required, but it's still an option.
No, but it isn't required anymore.
You don't have to do it that way anymore.
Well, but if you don't do it the way, then you don't get the benefits of it. The benefit of following that procedure under the Interstate Commerce Act was that you had the right against the consignee. That was an Interstate Commerce Act.
I don't argue with you at all about that. But that law is gone, and I guess what I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding is, you know, we want to keep commercial transactions flowing. We don't want to do things to get in the way of them. And if we're going to hold, as you ask us to, that you can rely only on the shipper because he's your customer, then why would you want to do that? You're giving up the ability to rely on the consignee, but what do you get for giving that up?
You get the way of business that you want to do it. You get the right to contract free of the obligations or the limitations imposed by law. If you want to act according to the rules of common carriage, you can do so. You get benefits. If you want to act according to the rules of contract carriage, which means you can negotiate your own deal and you can leave the consignee out of the deal, you accept the detriments of that relationship. All of the creditors that I have, that I am representing in this receivership, extended credit to MBM. You can't say that that's an unbusinesslike decision. Taz's extended credit. Taz's was willing to go unpaid for 110 days and was accepting that and was continuing to function.
Counselor, are any of the other creditors with a three-party relationship, or do they just have a two-party relationship between the creditor and MBM as the debtor? Here we have a three-party relationship. Any other three-party relationship?
No, we don't. We have a two-party relationship under an agreement between Taz and MBM, and we have the people who are receiving the goods from MBM, as far as they're concerned, pursuant to their contract with MBM. They're not party to any contract. They're no more or less the beneficiaries of Taz's services than they are of the concrete that was sold, the cement that was sold and became part of the concrete, or the aggregate that was sold and became part of the concrete, which they purchased.
Taz and MBM had a contractual relation. It was an oral contract?
Apparently, which, of course, you couldn't have under common law.
Okay. Well, one of the problems is there seems to be a dispute between the parties as to what the terms of that contract were. From you, it was a contract between Taz and MBM that Taz ships, MBM pays Taz.
That's
what your contract is. From Taz's description, I get the impression that the deal was Taz could go to either one of them. That's one way of interpreting it. Or would look first to MBM, but if MBM didn't pay, would go to the person who gets the shipment. And this is a summary judgment case.
Right. Unagreed facts, basically.
Well,
Taz moved for summary judgment.
I know, but I'm having trouble finding out what the agreed facts are. That's my little problem. I mean, even if I understood the law, which is another issue. But do you know what I'm saying?
I do understand. But what Taz is saying is, you take this one discussion which took place between us, two-thirds of the way down the road.
I understand that.
And attach the legal significance to that that will incur legal liability by parties who didn't know about that conversation, who didn't know what the deal was, who didn't agree to pay separately for freight, and who have paid their contractual obligations to MBM. And I'm saying, as a rule of law, in that sense, the discussion becomes irrelevant.
Thank you, Mr. Stoyer.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Janicek?
You just answered questions.
We have all questions about the area. I was supposed to come.
Well, you can shed additional light on them.
It isn't unusual for two parties in an appeal like this to be like ships passing in the night with respect to how the law is to be interpreted, but I've never seen a case where the parties are two ships passing in the night with respect to what the facts are, the way that seems to be the case here.
What's your version of the facts?
Well, I think my version is pretty much the same as Mr. Stoyer's version. It's our position in this case that unlike the traditional situation going back some 80 years in Wisconsin case law where you had a three-party contract, imagine a triangle with the shipper, the carrier, and the consignee, all parties to that contract and all linked together by that uniform bill of lading, which spelled out, first of all, how much the shipping, what the rate was and how much those charges were. So everybody knew it. And also spelled out the responsibilities and the liabilities of the parties to each other. Now, much has been made about the fact that the Uniform Bill of Lading is no longer required. That's true. So what? What takes its place? What takes its place is the agreement and arrangement reached by the parties.
And what was that deal?
And that arrangement, as expressed in the, it was two separate, it was two sides of that triangle instead of three. It was the agreement between MBM and the customers, whereby MBM sold to the customers, and this, according to the record, is absolutely consistent with construction industry practice. This is the way it's done.
It was sold as delivered goods.
As delivered.
What does that mean?
Delivered goods with no breakout in the costs. And the record indicates it's all of the costs of MBM that were included in delivery, including freight, not broken out. The customer gets a bill for one amount of money for the goods that are sold, and the customer pays MBM. Separate and independent of that is the arrangement between MBM and TAS, the carrier. And that arrangement calls for TAS to invoice MBM weekly for all of the deliveries made, all the truckloads, I think they're called on the invoices, made the prior week without any breakout as to delivery. And the rate for that delivery is set by rate sheets issued by MBM and a list of terms and conditions. There's no signed agreement anywhere between TAS and MBM. There is a written rate sheet, and there is a written list of terms and conditions which make adjustments to the rates that are going to be paid based upon a number of factors. And so the practice is MBM gets billed by TAS weekly, and MBM pays those invoices, albeit not particularly timely after the first invoice or two. After the first invoice or two, we're looking at a 30 to 60 day period delay between invoice and payment. And that goes on. And when it gets to the point of being roughly 60 days and you're in the middle of summer, TAS obviously isn't happy with that situation. Perhaps it's a cash flow issue. We don't know exactly. But TAS, at that point, now bear in mind, we've got an argument here coming from the other side that says, well, TAS had the right to collect from either the consignor or the consignee. That was its right. TAS had that right. TAS understood it had that right. It isn't spelled out anywhere. The consignee doesn't know about it. The consignee isn't even told the amount of shipping charges anywhere, but TAS has that right. Well, I would submit to this court, when it gets to 60 days, what would a carrier do who believed it had the right to collect its charges from the customer?
Isn't part of the problem here, Ms. Janicek, the fact that perhaps, and maybe I want to read into this more than I should, that TAS is under the assumption that it's dealing with MBM in good faith when, in fact, MBM, as we now know, was not doing what it was supposed to with the monies it was receiving based on the contract that it had with Marine Bank. And MBM was putting monies in other areas and not really following through what they were supposed to be doing. So you've got this third cog in this triangle that is not following the rules. when it appears that the other two calls are. Isn't that part of what the problem is?
I guess I would disagree with that. We have a situation here where you've got a carrier who says, I can be paid in two different ways. But instead of issuing, what would a carrier do in that situation? It would cut an invoice. It would issue an invoice to that customer. It says, well, this is our right under the law. And it would say, for X shipment, you owe me X dollars. But it didn't do that. It didn't do that in 60 days.
Counselor, I think, you know, when you're dealing back and forth with people on a regular business and it's a customer, to do what you suggest is a fairly hostile act. I mean, they could have kept the goods and drove up to the door and said, here they are. We haven't been paid in 60 days, so we're not letting these off the truck until you cut us a check, or we'll sit here and you figure out about getting a check. They certainly could have done that, right? But that certainly would have disrupted the relationship of the parties, the flow of goods. So, I mean, oftentimes there are remedies, but there are, you know, it's more complicated than saying, well, you couldn't do it, so you didn't do it, so you gave up.
Well, that's true. But the point is that the extension of credit that occurred here, not by written agreement, but by fact, first up to 60 days, and then through the factoring of those receivables, where TAS accepted a discount on what it was entitled to receive from the factor, and the factor in turn collected it, that took it out to 90 days. By choosing to go that route, TAS put itself in a position where, when that company became insolvent, it was a creditor and owed money. Sure, might it have disrupted the relationship to take an aggressive position? Yes. It would have disrupted the relationship if they stopped dealing with TAS, but that was an option, too.
Well, is that the rule that we should write in this case, that these folks lose from TAS, but the next five, as soon as you're not paid, keep that goods on the truck and don't let them off the truck? Because if you do, you're going to get stung for the cartage costs.
No, I don't think this court case calls for that ruling at all.
But our ruling covers more than this case. And if I buy your argument vis-a-vis TAS, it's going to apply to Schneider Trucking and every other trucking company that has similar concerns about payment. So I'm kind of looking beyond your argument to the rule of law that, you know, that you're urging us to apply here. And one of the things you're saying is they could have sent an invoice right away. They didn't. Therefore, they became a creditor. You agree with me they could have kept the stuff on the truck till they were paid. I mean, we can put both of those in our opinion, but I'm not sure that that's good commercial practice.
That's not, but I'm not sure that that doesn't reach way beyond the issue before the court.
Well, tell me what the rule of law you're proposing is.
Okay. Well, I would submit, first of all, that the issue before the court is, what was the arrangement between the parties, and did that arrangement between the parties permit TAS to collect its trucking fees from the customers? Or alternatively, was TAS required by virtue of the arrangement reached between the parties, the course of dealings that went on unchanged for 10 months, to look exclusively to MBM?
Can we do that as a matter of law? Sounds like a question of fact to me.
Well, the underlying facts are not in dispute, the legal conclusions one draws from those facts, i.e., whether or not there in fact was an applied agreement to that effect, and for that matter, to take into account where the plaintiffs are coming from, which is not whether there was an agreement, but whether, despite whatever the parties agreed to, that's why I'm just having a
question. Whether there was an agreement is a matter of fact, which requires a meeting of the minds of the parties. And you have opposing counsel saying, we never agreed to this. We went along with it because it was working at the moment. How can we decide as a matter of law that that was the agreement?
Well, I guess I wouldn't agree that opposing counsel is saying they never agreed to that. There seems to be some question as to whether or not there's a three-way contract here, perhaps.
Right, that's what I mean.
And, of course, we submit there couldn't possibly be, since you have customers who don't have any idea what the shipping charges are, and nobody's ever given them a single piece of paper that tells them that they have responsibility for shipping charges, independent of the invoice coming from MBM.
See, what's bothering me is a little bit different than that. What's bothering me is, A, first of all, did they have the right before they made this court agreement, as you see it, to collect from the consignee? Okay, that's going to be a question we'll find the answer to in case law. If they did they agree to give that up by accepting payments from MBM? And that's the part that to me feels factual, that second part. Well, what do you think?
I guess I wouldn't characterize the issue so narrowly. It may be whether they agreed to give that up not only by accepting payments from MBM, but also by extending credit to MBM, which is inherently inconsistent with this notion that you have a right to collect from another party, and by failing at any time, for that matter, to use either a standard, a uniform bill of lading at the outset, or to disclose in some other manner the amount of the shipping charges to the customers, and the fact that there was liability or responsibility for those shipping charges to the carrier on the part of the customer, who had independently agreed to pay for delivered goods to MBM. It's all of the factors that go into the course of dealing that have to be taken into account in resolving the issue of whether or not they lost that right. It's not simply the fact of having made payments to MBM. It's the whole course of dealings between and among the parties.
May I ask you a question about the receiverships?
I'll try to answer it.
I believe that you filed legal papers on January 22, 2003.
That sounds right.
And there was a hearing on January 24, 2003.
I believe that's correct.
And there was an injunction issued at that hearing?
I believe it was a temporary restraining order.
Did TAS's participate in that January 24th hearing?
Yes, it did.
So they got notice and they participated?
Yes, they did. It wasn't an ex parte. It was not an ex parte, TRO, if that's what you're asking.
Now, thing that, again, this is summary judgment. This is summary judgment, right?
That is correct. It was both parties asked for summary judgment.
Right. And I see that there's a separate box, so there must be a large number of documents, right? Ordinarily in a summary judgment with affidavits and some parts of depositions, we really don't have a lot because you have to have no material issues of fact, right? Isn't that right? You have to agreed upon facts, or at least facts that are material are not disputed, right?
That's true, but I think we also need to keep in mind that the legal theory on which this case was litigated in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals is different than the legal theory now being argued.
I know, because somehow cases were not cited to the Court of Appeals, right?
I don't believe it's a matter of, well, yes, early Wisconsin cases and the argument that went with those cases was not raised to the Court of Appeals. Both sides agreed that Schneider National controlled.
I asked you what rule of law you wanted to come out of this case, and you responded to me, first we have to decide what were the arrangements between the parties. Could TAS collect from the consignee? Or was TAS required to look exclusively to the consignor, right?
That's the issue, yes.
Right. Now, so what is, if it's summary judgment, the arrangement has to be, seems to me, undisputed. If it's a dispute, we got to make a decision on the facts, right?
I would agree that if there are disputes of material fact, then summary judgment is
Are they here? Are there any disputes here?
I don't believe that there are disputed material facts.
All right. And it's your position that the arrangement between TAS and MBM is TAS looks to MBM, not the consignee, for payment.
That is correct.
It has to do it exclusively. because that's their contract.
Well, no. That was the issue presented. If I were to turn it into the rule of law, it would be in the absence of a uniform bill of lading or a delivery document that similarly creates a three-way contract whereby the consignee is advised of the shipping charges and is advised of its liability for same to the carrier. Okay. In the absence of that, the determination of the rights of the parties turns upon the agreement between and among the parties. And if that agreement isn't express, then it turns on the course of dealing between and among the parties.
Okay, and there's no such express three-party agreement here.
That is correct.
And everybody, well, that's what your position is, not expressed here. Therefore, you look to the course of dealings.
Well, there's no three-party agreement at all. There's no express two-party. There are no written two-party agreements either.
You can have an express oral contract.
Correct. Well, there certainly is an express oral contract with respect to who bills whom, okay, as between the carrier and MBM and as between the customers and MBM.
So if there's not an express contract, then you look to the course of dealing, and
correct,
you have a course of dealing here of a few months, you say, in which TAS looked to MBM.
TAS looked to MBM. The customers paid MBM for delivered goods. Credit was extended, and all of the other factors that have been discussed.
Did TAS continue to make deliveries after January 24th, 2003?
The record reflects that TAS never ceased making deliveries, and that following the appointment of the receiver and the sale of the company to a new entity, which goes by the name, I think, Modern Building Materials, LTD, or something like that, or LLP, TAS continued and has continued to ship for the new Modern.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt. Is there an agreement on the facts here?
No, there is not.
And what are we doing here on summary judgment?
From our position, under the rule of law announced by this court, whether or not the parties dispute what their oral agreement was is irrelevant, because under that rule of law, TAS had the right to collect from consignees, period. Unless there is a written agreement that the parties lived by, and the consignee would be damaged if TAS were allowed to collect from it.
So, Counsel, if I understand you right, you had a right to be paid by the consignee under your theory.
Yes.
You could have given that up by an express contract, but it must be written or you can't give it up. Is that correct?
That is my understanding of the law, and the only cases which have deviated from what this court has held in the past have discussed written express contracts. They aren't here, so we don't even get to that issue.
Mr. Schmidt, just so I can follow up, assume for sake of your question only that we disagree with that your approach, and we agree with Ms. Janicek, that if there's no express agreement, you can look at the course of dealing. I guess my question is whether or not the dispute between the parties is as to the facts, or is the dispute as to the inferences to be drawn from those facts?
Both. What, from the position of TAS, there was no agreement to look solely to MBM for payment.
So whether there's an agreement or not, I think, would be an inference.
Well, we probably do not disagree. I cannot think of offhand any material facts we disagree on. It certainly would be the inferences to be drawn from those. My argument is we don't have to reach that because we have an absolute right to collect from consignees, except in very, very limited circumstances.
So it's really a question of what law you apply. Both of you agree there's no express agreement that's tripartite here.
Correct.
Your view is if you don't have an express agreement that's tripartite, you can collect from either one of them, and the consignee is liable because they got the benefit of your carriage.
Exactly. Right?
Unless they're hurt in some way.
Right.
All right. Because they may have already paid MBM. All right. The other parties agree, I think, that if you don't have a three-part contract, you got to go to MBM, the consignor.
If we don't have a three-party contract, no, I do not agree with that at all.
No, you don't, but that's their position.
Their position, yes.
So if we decide which position of the law is correct, it can be applied to these facts because you both agree there isn't a three-party contract here.
That's correct.
Okay.
Did Taz's, were you there at that January 24th hearing?
No, I was not. I was retained only after the Court of Appeals decision.
Well, only after the
Court? After the Court of Appeals decision, yes.
Is it fair to say that the cases that you've cited here, like Waters, were not cited to the Court of Appeal?
I know, in fact, that the Crone case was. I remember seeing that in the briefing papers to the Court of Appeals. I do not recollect off the top of my head whether the other two prior cases were, but I know that Crone was. Let me make a couple points that I think are very important. There is no such thing as a uniform bill of lading. I keep hearing this, uniform bill of lading, there is nothing like that. The regulation by the ICC is 49 CFR 373.101, bills of lading. And I will read it. Every motor common carrier shall issue a receipt or a bill of lading for property tendered for transportation, interstate or foreign commerce, containing the following information: name of consignor and consignee, origin and destination points, number of packages, description of freight, weight, volume, or measurement of freight, if applicable to the rating of the freight. That's it. Nothing in there about the cost of carriage. I've heard this from...
Give me that site again.
Yes, Your Honor. It is 49 CFR 373.101. That is the current state of the law as to what a bill of lading has to consist.
Nothing in the UCC about bill of lading. Somehow I remember when I went to law school pre-UCC, there was a form that said bill of lading.
We have said that.
I thought it was a...
And right now, the bill of lading under Wisconsin law, chapter 407 point, and I can't, it's in the brief, it's a very, it's much shorter even than this.
No UCC form?
No. No. No longer any forms.
Okay.
There is no standard bill of lading. Let me address one thing. I think it was raised by Justice Prosser regarding the payment of, Mr. Stoyer raised the issue of the supplier of the materials for the concrete and the laborers, et cetera. Those are all pre-product components. What we have here is a carrier which it supplies a benefit to a third party, which is the consignee. It's not picking apart part of the price and saying, oh, we get to come in and take this much or that much. They have provided a service to the consignee. The consignee is liable. It's that embarrassingly simple.
Simple for
him.
Well, I want to ask you one thing just so I'm sure about your position vis-a-vis what I was questioning your opinion
yes, sure.
about. If we were to say that you, A, don't need a three-party agreement, and B, that the express agreement could be oral, do you believe there are questions of fact about whether there was an express agreement with those two assumptions, with which I know you don't agree?
I agree with you, yes.
Yeah, but so that for that part, there are questions of fact in your view.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. What's the fact question? About whether there was an agreement, that's what I was asking.
whether there was an oral agreement.
Whom? Between whom
between
and whom?
CAS and MBM.
You have something. You shipped for them.
They agreed on price, that's all.
They didn't agree they'd pay?
No, there's nothing in the record which says there was an agreement as to who would pay. What?
Was there itemization per customer? Did you itemize per customer or did you itemize per week in general for MBM?
I believe they did it by week. That's my understanding.
So if it was $100 or $1,000 a week, I didn't know if the shipment went to Butler or Prosser or Bradley or myself. And I didn't know how much. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Thanks. Thank you, Court.
Didn't know who it was. That was not a problem, I understand.